Senior citizen, her sassy, smart self is coming to Oakland for a KPFA benefit. That's Melissa Harris Perry, the very bright, very witty, outspoken professor of political science, often seen on The Rachel Maddow Show on MSNBC. Henry Louis Gates Jr. says she's one of our most trenchant readers of modern black life. Indeed, she is. Melissa's new book, titled Sister Citizen, is all about black women in America. Our host will be Blanche Richardson, the longtime proprietor of Marcus Books. This KPFA benefit happens Monday, October 24th at St. Paul's Church, 114 Montecito Avenue, just off Grand Avenue in Oakland. There's wheelchair access. Tickets are $12 in advance at brownpapertickets.com or at Marcus Books or other supportive bookstores. Go online to kpfa.org for more information. Do not miss Melissa Harris Perry, October 24th. And you are listening to 94.1 KPFA in Berkeley, 89.3 KPFB in Berkeley, 88.1 KFCF in Fresno, and online at kpfa.org. The time is a minute past 1 p.m. Up next is Guns and Butter.
This is Guns and Butter.
Something happening, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
Yeah, that's right.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Welcome to Guns and Butter. I wanted to let everyone know at the top of the hour here that Guns and Butter will go for 2.5 hours today. From 2 p.m. to 3 p.m., we'll continue with 9/11 programming, so I hope you can stay tuned for that. But right now, from 1 to 2 p.m. today on Guns and Butter, we're featuring You, Me, and the Security and Prosperity Partnership, Trading Democracy for Corporate Rule, a Canadian film produced by Paul Manley. This is a very important hour and a half film that dissects the secret trade agreements and investment agreements between Canada, the U.S., and Mexico. In Canada, it's called the Security and Prosperity Partnership, but it's better known here in the U.S. as the North American Union.
Do you know what the Security Prosperity Partnership is?
No.
Do you guys know what the Security Prosperity Partnership is?
No, not at all.
Have you ever heard of it before?
A few seconds ago.
Have you folks heard of the Security Prosperity Partnership before?
No, I haven't.
No, I haven't.
Nope.
Never heard of it?
No.
Have you ever heard of TILMA, the Trade, Investment, Labor, Mobility Agreement?
No, I haven't.
Do you know what the Trade, Investment, Labor, Mobility Agreement is?
No.
No?
No. I'm not familiar with that either.
These people aren't unique. Like most Canadians, they have no idea what the Security Prosperity Partnership or the Trade Investment Labor Mobility Agreement are. That's because the SPP and TILMA were negotiated behind closed doors, and our governments have not properly informed the Canadian public about what these agreements entail. Trade is an essential component of human interaction. But over the last couple of decades, trade negotiations and agreements have become increasingly secretive and have excluded civil society in the negotiations. Human rights, labor rights, safety standards, and environmental considerations have been left off the table and are considered irrelevant. Unlike the people I interviewed on the street, I had heard something about the SPP and TILMA. But these agreements seem beyond my scope as a filmmaker, beyond my power as a citizen, and not something I was prepared to tackle head-on. Or so I thought. In reality, the SPP would lead me to shooting the most watched clip of video I have ever produced, and this issue would consume my life.
No, no, no! Put the rock down, man! Put the rock down! This is all mine!
Before I started on this project, I had been concentrating on developing films about the positive contributions people were making to creating a better world. Projects like improving local food production to combat climate change, or the creation of a co-housing community that has environmental sustainability as its guiding principle. I was fundraising for a youth video project about water issues when I approached the local chapter of the Council of Canadians. They didn't have any funds, but they inspired me with another idea. They were making presentations about Tilma to various city councils, and I began to realize the effect that Tilma and the SPP would have on the issues I was concerned with.
Stop Tilma!
Before I knew it, I was traveling around, conducting interviews, and gaining a deeper understanding of what Tilma and the SPP were really about.
Well, the Security and Prosperity Partnership, that was an idea set up right after September 11th, when the Americans shut down the border for a few days and really scared the Canadian corporations. They knew the Americans were going to put up the security perimeter around the United States. So what the corporations in Canada said, the top 150 corporations and the Canadian Council of Chief Executives said, let's be inside that perimeter. Let's make that a North American security perimeter. And then if we then go along with the Americans on their military, on their human rights, on their Patriot Act, on immigration and refugee policy, on energy, on all kinds of regulations over pesticides or whatever, then they will allow us access to their market.
So they said, for prosperity, we need to give them what they need, are asking for on security. So they proposed this Security Prosperity Partnership, which our three governments signed in Waco, Texas on March 2005. It was a totally and profoundly undemocratic process. Nobody was asked except the big business community, who still co-governed through another organization that got set up, which was the North American Competitiveness Council. Did not go to the legislatures of the three countries.
What the SPP really represents is a parallel government, so that the important decisions are either made outside of Parliament and outside of the legislatures, or they make it impossible for those kinds of decisions to be made in those legislative bodies. So that democracy is slowly being gutted, even though we still have the facade, we still got Parliament buildings, we still have, you know, parties running in elections. I don't think those things are going to disappear anytime soon. Because why would they? They don't have to get rid of those.
Well, essentially what you've got is the federal government, both under the Liberals and under the Conservatives, pushing forward this agenda with 19 working groups that involves essentially every minister or every ministry within the federal government.
And so what we are seeing happening with the SPP is a move to something called deeper integration. That means policy harmonization and regulatory reform without changing a single law, without having to go to Parliament or to any kind of legislature to try to make these changes. They said that the battle was so severe last time, they want to avoid it. So they're going underground. And that is a real threat to democracy.
What the Canadian Council Chief Executive said when they came before the Parliamentary Committee, I can remember it clear as day, because it was so stunning in its simplicity, but also in its dishonesty. They said the public is not ready for this agenda. Essentially, that's why it has to take place behind closed doors. What they're saying is Canadians knew the extent of the Security and Prosperity Partnership. They'd reject it.
We met with the American Embassy recently, and I asked senior officials at the American Embassy why it had not gone to the legislatures of the three countries. And they said that none of the governments nor the business communities in the three countries wanted another, and I quote, bruising NAFTA battle. That's what they actually said. I couldn't believe the honesty with which he told me that, because our government's never admitted that.
It disturbs us that democracy is actually being stolen away from us under this guise of this corporate, competitive, global agenda.
The ultimate goal, quite obviously, is to create such tight integration that effectively we only have one North American political, security, military, and economic place, that there really are no differentials between this country and the country next door.
Undemocratic? A parallel level of government? A process that affects every ministry of the federal government and over 300 regulatory areas? Deep integration of our security and military infrastructure with the United States? The SPP is a tight web of intergovernmental agreements designed to increase corporate wealth and extend U.S.-style homeland security control throughout Canada and Mexico. The more I learned about the Security Prosperity Partnership, the more disturbing I found it. I knew I needed to get the proponent's side of the argument, so I began writing and phoning government ministers and asking for interviews.
I'm calling to request an interview with the minister.
When?
Whenever he's available. I'm actually calling from British Columbia. I could arrange to do an interview in BC, or I could arrange to have an interview done in Ottawa.
Which media are you with?
I'm an independent documentary producer.
What do you want to talk to him about?
The Security Prosperity Partnership.
The subject of my documentary, and probably a quick Google search of my name, produced a consistent result from both federal and provincial government ministers.
Joanne Fleming from Ministry of Economic Development Communications Department. You had sent an email to Minister Colin Hanson's email address asking if he would like to participate in a documentary, and Fleming thought, you know, unfortunately he's not available. But thanks very much for the invitation, and have a great day. Okay, thanks. Bye.
Since I couldn't find anyone who would explain to me why the SPP and TILMA are good things for Canadian citizens, I had to rely solely on the people who had studied these agreements and could explain to me what was wrong with these processes.
The Canadian government says the Security Prosperity Partnership is neither an agreement nor a treaty, but a dialogue.
As I learned more, sharing the information I gathered became more urgent. Whenever and wherever I had a chance, I would talk to people about what I knew about the SPP and TILMA. I also asked people if they noticed changes in their lives, and I met with Canadians who had been directly affected by this agenda. The SPP and TILMA cover a broad spectrum of issues, which I have sorted into short chapters for this film. But first of all, we need to understand how we got to our current situation.
I think it's really clear that we've been moving away from democratic control, you know, really for almost 20 years. In fact, its formulation goes back even further. It goes back to the mid-1970s when the Trilateral Commission, which is an international boys club of very powerful politicians and CEOs, published a book called The Crisis in Democracy. And the crisis was, and I quote, "There is an excess of democracy." In other words, people's expectations about what governments can provide had gotten far too large, and we had to lower those expectations in order to make liberal democracy work for business. So that in the mid-1970s, and remember, this is when we, you know, all these new social programs were coming to the fore. We'd had Medicare for maybe 8 years, unemployment insurance was there, tuition fees at university were very low, and corporations at that point were also at their lowest level of profitability in many years. And so there was a major push right across the developed countries, but mostly in the English-speaking countries, United States, Canada, Britain, Australia, New Zealand, to begin to counter some of the ideas of liberal democracy and social democracy.
Those ideas were countered in a systematic way in the 1980s, after the election of Ronald Reagan in the United States, Margaret Thatcher in Britain, and the Brian Mulroney Conservatives in Canada. These right-wing governments, along with the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, developed a new way of thinking, known as the Washington Consensus, where market forces would be the determining factor in the policy decisions of governments, and free trade and deregulation the new mode of operation. In 1989, Canada and the United States signed a free trade agreement, and in 1994, Mexico joined in to what became known as NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement.
When NAFTA was proposed, the sort of architects of the Free Trade Agreement said to people in all three of the countries in NAFTA, Canada, and the United States, that with a free flow of goods across borders and with an openness of markets, that wealth would be able to move between the three countries. They said that, sure, it'll probably sit in the hands of the wealthy for a while, but there will be a trickle-down effect, which will positively impact both the middle class and the poorer classes in all three countries.
Since that first free trade agreement was signed in 1989, two-thirds of Canadian families have seen their real incomes fall. The wealthiest 20% have seen their incomes increase by almost 20%, and they now take home half the income pie in Canada. The upper middle class have seen no real change. While the middle class have lost a week's worth of income, the lower middle class have lost 2 weeks' worth of income, and the lowest income Canadians have lost 6 weeks' worth of income in real terms since 1989. During this same time period, the average debt per Canadian family has doubled.
Jobs now in manufacturing that we're losing at $22 an hour with benefits are being replaced with jobs at $12 an hour with no benefits. We're actually creating an underclass in our society, again, by design and cooperation from the people we elected to look after our interests.
So really, families are now living on what they were living on in the late 1980s, although in order to do so, of course, we now see an enormous amount of stress in terms of work-life balance. But of course, it's not just that part of people's lives. It's also what academics will call the social wage. So not only are we losing in terms of actual real income, we are losing in terms of the income, in quotation marks, that we get from Medicare, from low tuition fees, unemployment insurance, all those things. Those are decreasing too. And that's part of our standard of living. And it's certainly part of our quality of life. So, you know, extrapolate into the future. As long as this power imbalance continues, as long as citizens don't react and don't change things, we can see more of the same, that working people and middle-class people will continue to struggle to maintain their quality of life, and the super rich will get super richer.
While free trade has widened the gap between the rich and the poor in Canada and the United States, it has had a devastating effect on Mexican citizens.
As soon as NAFTA came into effect, we saw a huge spring up of the maquilas or sweatshop factories along the Mexico border, and we saw people rushing to get these jobs because they had believed they were going to be paid, you know, if not a minimum wage, a fair wage, if not, they'd just be paying a living wage for these jobs. But none of that actually transpired. The section along the Mexico-U.S. border became this, you know, free trade zone of environmental degradation, of human suffering, because the corporations that were there, they weren't interested in building community, they weren't interested in being there for any amount of time. Of course, they're corporations, so they're just going to pick up and move to wherever the cheapest labor is going to be. Over 10 years in NAFTA, we saw three quarters of the family farms in Mexico basically stop existing. People moved to urban centers in search of jobs, both because they were promised by NAFTA, but also because in the agricultural zone or in agriculture areas in Mexico, the United States was now allowed to dump commodities. And corn was the biggest example of this. They would dump the subsidized commodities from the United States into Mexico. Thus, the Mexican market was flooded with much cheaper corn that then could be produced locally. And of course, this sounds crazy because Mexico is the birthplace of corn, and it's, you know, people's staple in life. So the fact that it could come cheaper from the United States was something that really just shows this race to the bottom in terms of how cheap things can get once they're completely opened up to the market.
Estimates range everywhere from 1.5 million to over 16 million Mexicans have been displaced, and as a result, these displaced Mexican farmers and Mexican people, including indigenous people in Mexico, are forced to migrate to places like the U.S. and Canada, where they now form a vastly exploitable pool of labor for the North American economies.
One of the most problematic provisions in NAFTA is Chapter 11, which allows corporations to sue governments for measures that threaten their investments. In the latest Chapter 11 challenge, Dow Chemical is seeking a $2 million settlement after the province of Quebec banned the use of pesticides for cosmetic purposes, including the Dow Chemical product 2,4-D. Pesticides are a known health hazard, and governments should be able to place limits on their use without the threat of lawsuits. The unfulfilled promises of trade agreements, combined with excessive provisions like Chapter 11 and the undemocratic nature of the negotiations, have led to a backlash against further free trade deals.
In Canada and around the world, there was a huge rejection of free trade policies. There had just been the Summit of the Americas in April 2001 in Quebec City, where tens of thousands of people took to the streets. Unprecedented coalitions to reject the idea of expanding NAFTA to all of the Americas, the free trade area of the Americas. And the reason why people were rejecting the FTAA is precisely because we had lived with NAFTA for 10 years and we were able to measure the rhetoric against the reality. So the last thing people wanted in 2001 was more NAFTA or a deeper NAFTA. But what happened after the shock of September 11th is that that crisis was expertly manipulated by our political leaders to push through a range of policies that they actually had wanted to push through before September 11th, but didn't have the political conditions that made that possible.
What is TILMA, the Trade Investment Labor Mobility Agreement, and how does it fit into the SPP?
The SPP will help reintroduce
the defeated multilateral agreement on investment back into North America through TILMA, the Trade, Investment and Labor Mobility Agreement, already in place between Alberta and British Columbia.
But the way to look at TILMA is to look at it as a part and parcel of the SPP. If you look at the SPP, in one major aspect of the SPP is massive deregulation. And the way they put it, of course, is harmonizing regulations between the three SPP countries, Mexico, Canada, and the U.S. But one of the problems for Canada is that most of the regulations in this country are actually provincial and municipal. So, in other words, the federal government can't actually deliver when it sits down to the negotiating table with the U.S. and they say, we want harmonization. Canada says, well, actually, we're having a problem with that because we don't control most of the regulations. So TILMA fills in that gap. TILMA is an essential part of the SPP. You can't complete the SPP without TILMA being signed on by every province.
Well, I'd say that the ostensible rationale for TILMA is really threefold. First, there's the notion that a lot of barriers exist between provinces to trade, investment, and labor mobility. Second is the idea that these barriers entail quite a significant economic cost. And third is this notion that the existing agreement on internal trade and ongoing negotiations between provincial governments aren't sufficient to address those perceived problems. And what TILMA does is it creates unprecedented power for private interests to challenge public policy, which is formulated in a democratic way. And the way in which it does this is by combining a very aggressive private enforcement mechanism with very broad language. The whole agreement is only 36 pages long, so it's very general and open to interpretation, and that interpretation will be done by commercial tribunals that meet behind closed doors rather than by Canadian courts. Its enforcement mechanism is very aggressive. It allows individuals and businesses to sue provincial governments for up to $5 million over a wide range of laws, policies, and regulations, including those maintained by municipalities and school boards.
We set our standards by the people we elect in a democratic process and ask them to put those processes in place. The corporations and the business community wants to set the standards on the basis of the lowest competitive advantage. That always means lowering standards, never raising standards in our experience.
One of the strangest things about this whole debate about TILMA is that almost no concrete examples of barriers have been provided. I've put the question to many prominent supporters of TILMA, including the chief economist of the conference board, the president of the C.D. Howe Institute, officials from the OECD, and officials from the IMF, what interprovincial barriers they're concerned about. And none of these peoples, none of these authorities can provide a clear list of what barriers they think are out there. I think the most commonly discussed barrier is the notion that the government of Quebec doesn't allow margarine sold in that province to be colored to look like butter.
You've been listening to You, Me, and the SPP, Trading Democracy for Corporate Rule, a Canadian film, 1.5 hours long. This first cut went over some of the history that led up to the Security and Prosperity Partnership Agreement. That was a little bit of the historical overview. This is an hour and a half DVD that goes over the history and the presence up to the present of where these secret trade agreements are. This is a very important film told from the Canadian point of view, produced by Paul Manley. And Paul Manley actually is very famous for having taken that footage of one of the protests in Quebec against the Security and Prosperity Partnership, where there were some people there with handkerchiefs over their faces and they were trying to throw rocks at the police. He filmed it all, and it turned out later that they were police officers themselves, and his film actually forced the government to admit that. This film today, You, Me, and the SPP, Trading Democracy for Corporate Rule is our thank you gift today in the first hour on Guns and Butter for a $100 contribution to KPFA. It's a terrific DVD. It even has a 12-minute version. You'll hear well-known people like Maude Barlow and Naomi Klein, both Canadians, of course, and lots of other Canadians speaking out against these trade treaties. And it really deconstructs a very complex subject, and it is discussed that they have taken these agreements sort of secret. There's no more fanfare and big announcements. They're doing what is called incrementalizing these agreements. And of course, this supersedes all of the local and national government regulations, both in Canada and Mexico. And here in this country, we call it the North American Union. I'd love to get a few people on the phone before we go back to the film at 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732, or 510-848-5732. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. You're listening to Guns and Butter. This is the third week of the KPFA Fall Fun Drive. You, me, and the SPP, Trading Democracy for Corporate Rule. We showed this at the 9/11 Film Festival this year. It was quite a hit. It's a terrific film. You've just heard a little bit of the history, but these trade agreements cover all aspects of policy. The Trade Investment and Labor Mobility Agreement, or TILMA, you heard them mention that, and the Security and Prosperity Partnership, or SPP, will reintroduce the Multilateral Agreement on Investment, which was negotiated out of the WTO and NAFTA in the late 1990s because of strong public opposition. And I remember the Multilateral Agreement on Investment. That was defeated. And I remember in 1999 at the Battle of Seattle, I went up there. I was there for those huge demonstrations against the World Trade Organization. And, of course, 9/11 ended the global protest movement against the WTO and these trade treaties. So we don't hear so much about them anymore. It's all being negotiated between governments and corporations. So this is a really very, very important film. I'd love to get another few people on the phone, 1-800-439-5732 or 510-848-5732, $100 donation to your station, KPFA, and we can send you this really very important DVD from Canada, 1-800-439-5732. Of course, we also have our DVD from our last 2 weeks, the 9/11 Explosive Evidence, Experts Speak Out. We're going to play a new cut from that in the second hour, that for $100. 1-800-439-5732, 510-848-5732. You, me, and the Security and Prosperity Partnership, Trading Democracy for Corporate Rule. Let's go on and hear the second cut.
On February 14th, 2008, the Canadian and United States militaries quietly signed a deal that allows these military forces to cross borders into the neighboring country in cases of civil unrest, pandemic, or other emergencies.
There has been a move over several decades to more closely integrate Canada and the United States at the military level. Now, we've had close cooperation between the two countries in the military dimension for some time. We, of course, were allied partners in the Second World War. We came together in NORAD, the North American Air Defense Command, and later North American Aerospace Defense Command. So it's not as if we haven't cooperated before, but there has been pressure to bring our armed forces ever closer together, and we've seen that in terms of the expansion of NORAD to include a maritime surveillance dimension. We've seen this with the development of something called the Binational Planning Group. And this is all linked most recently to American concerns post 9/11. that have driven a concern for homeland security. And homeland security for the United States is viewed as North American security. The Binational Planning Group also identified that the concerns of ordinary Canadians about losing their sovereignty, that those concerns were the main impediment, the main concern to proponents of greater military integration, and actually suggested that some of these incremental steps and an incremental approach were the best way of getting around this impediment of Canadian sovereignty and sentiments about sovereignty.
One of the most ominous aspects of the Security Prosperity Partnership is the adoption of U.S.-style security measures that undermine our most basic rights and freedoms.
We know the Security and Prosperity Partnership, in its very name, has a security framework, which particularly in the post 9/11 climate, is very much about security, militarization, things like the no-fly list, CCTVs. So all of these we know have a specific impact. It has the impact on everybody. Civil liberties of everyone is impacted. So I don't think anyone is safe from these so-called security measures. And they're about trying to gain access to the privacy rights and in violation of the civil liberties of all people who reside in North America. There's definitely no doubt about that.
My husband was detained 43 months without charge or access to the evidence because the government thought he was a terrorist in the past, present, or in the future. After 43 months in detention, my husband was released on bail with the toughest bail conditions in Canadian history. He wears a GPS tracking device. We have surveillance cameras on the front and the back of our residence to monitor every single move. The phone and the mail is intercepted. We are allowed 3 outings a week, up to 4 hours, supervised by bulletproof vest-wearing officers. And every person who enters a residence has to be pre-approved, including family members. My computer is on the lock. I cannot have a cell phone. We have a curfew. We have boundaries within the city, and the list goes on.
One of the many anti-terrorism measures that Canada has adopted from the United States is the no-fly list.
That particular list, even among security experts, is something of a laughingstock. Of course, it's not very funny if you're the person who's caught out in it. Its false positive rate is through the roof, and it has proved itself to be a complete and utter fiasco.
One of those false positives is Glenda Hutton, a retired elementary school teacher from Courtenay, B.C.
Air Canada and Comox were the first ones to inform me that I was on a no-fly list, but I have been told by Transport Canada now that I am not on the Canadian list. I was told initially that Interpol had put my name on the list. I assume I'm on Homeland Security's list in the States. They won't tell me whether I am on one of their lists or not until I actually have a problem on U.S. soil. They seem to think that that's the only way I am going to figure this out, is if I do try and fly out of the States back into Canada and see what happens. So I take the risk of not knowing and the risk of being detained, whether it's for an hour or 6 hours or overnight. So that makes it difficult for me to plan any trips.
These are apparently people who are so dangerous that they cannot fly, but they can go to the store, they can go to the park, they can walk into your children's school. Because they're so dangerous they can't fly, but they're not dangerous enough to arrest, even for conspiracy.
I've had my fingerprints done. I've had a criminal records check done. I have a police certificate that says I am who I am. They know where I live. And I even applied to Ottawa for a pardon, which I paid for. And that was to do so that I could get a letter from Ottawa saying that I have no evidence of any criminal activity.
I will say, when I talk to older people who remember McCarthyism, blacklisting, and everything else, this all has a very eerie ring. If we talk to our friends at the American Civil Liberties Union, they will talk about people who have written a fiery letter to the editor, disagreeing with something the government has done or some government policy or the war in Iraq or whatever, and then finding themselves bing the next time they go to fly on the no-fly list. That is a real danger. It's not a pretend danger.
We see that it specifically impacts, or primarily impacts, people who are seen as quote-unquote terrorists, which in our current day is defined or considered to be anyone who is South Asian or Muslim or Arab or Middle Eastern.
So the logic of no-fly is already deeply suspect, if not tragically flawed. And the criteria is secret, and where the information comes from is also unknown. It has always been part of the plan for phase two of where the U.S. was going to take their no-fly list, which was into a program in which every single passenger gets risk assessed. Not, we have a watch list of people we're particularly concerned about, but everyone. Grandma to little Betsy needs to pass through a screening in which their data, everything the government can collect, is put through a secret algorithm to assess their relative level of risk, without Congress really knowing about it at all. It was disclosed 4 years after the fact that a program called the Automated Targeting System had been doing exactly this kind of risk assessment on every person who went to or fro across the U.S. border. So that would be any of us. Any of us who crossed into the U.S. border in the last 4 years has had U.S. Customs gather together every piece of data they could get their hands on, including when's the last time you flew in, who you flew with, what kind of meals you ordered, maybe what books you had in your bag if Customs went through it, compiled together, and you've been risk assessed going to and from the U.S. border.
Every single traveler that crosses the border between Canada and the United States is being given a code, either a green, an orange, or a red code. That's been determined by the level of what they call the risk assessment. And these would be the business travelers that would be assigned the green light, and they can just, you know, carry on, go through the border with minimal intrusion into their lives.
The idea that our information, and there's always been information about us, has been discreetly held apart by having them in silos, right? Your medical information is over here, your driver's information is over here, your mortgage information is over here. Now, not only do we have the capacity to store information on you like we've never seen, collect information on you like you've never seen, because of course you leave a data trail every time you use your credit card, use your cell phone, do a Google search, you name it. We can link all of these databases. The data grab that is going on in the U.S. is absolutely mind-boggling, and it's very clear that the information-based approach to security, which is everything that Homeland Security is looking for, is something that Canadians, again, in keeping with how we have made these arrangements, is very keen to emulate.
Under the privatization agenda, more and more of the data that was originally handled by various levels of government is now being handled by corporations. For instance, the British Columbia Medical Services Plan data is being handled by Maximus, an American multinational that is subject to the U.S. Patriot Act. When part of the 2006 Canadian census was contracted out to Lockheed Martin, Saskatchewan resident Sandra Finley objected.
In 2006, I refused to fill in my census form. I had a very compelling reason for doing that. The government contracted out part of the Canadian census to Lockheed Martin Corporation. Lockheed Martin Corporation is an arms manufacturer. They are the American military complex. They're almost synonymous with American Defense Department. You don't want those people to have access to the very sensitive information that is in the census. I have a responsibility as a citizen to protest when the government is using taxpayers' dollars to enrich corporations that make their money by killing people. I do not want my tax dollars going to enrich these warmongers.
Sandra has been charged under the Statistics Act with failure to comply with the census. If she is found guilty, she faces a maximum $500 fine and 3 months in jail. Why would the Canadian government contract part of the census to the world's largest military contractor?
One of the agreements or one of the things that that's in play right now between the U.S. and Canada is the Total Information Awareness Program that the Department of Justice in Canada signed on to when the Liberals were in power. And the Total Information Awareness Program is basically a program and a project that is spearheaded by the U.S. where they're hoping to gain access to privacy information of all of the inhabitants of the earth. So they make no qualms about saying that they want access to information about every single person on this planet, you know, race, gender, creed, no bar.
The U.S. approach to information-based security has got a lot of heft behind it. So they're moving towards something that is a national ID card without being called a national ID card, because, of course, branding and marketing is very important around these things. The Real ID system is a national ID card. The push in Canada to get biometric citizenship data and various other things melded into something that can be used as a border document is clearly moving in the direction of something that looks like a national ID card.
In response to U.S. border security measures, Manitoba will begin offering an enhanced driver's license as an affordable and secure form of identification for travelers.
What it really does is not only is it potentially encrypting information about you that you're not aware of, but it's helping to link the databases. So that's one of the things that you think about. It's like, this is a means to put a bunch of pieces together about you. People talk about ubiquitous computing. They have swipe cards to get where they need to go. The ability to track people in space geographically, to track their actions through things like smart cards, credit cards, and various other things, it's just unprecedented. And the idea is not only that we leave this data trail, but it's becoming more and more economically viable to maintain that data, i.e. to store it. We can actually do this in ways that weren't possible before. It's very important that citizens start speaking up about, yes, we do have privacy rights, and not rolling over on this notion that privacy is so yesterday.
The agenda of the Security Prosperity Partnership is not completely secretive. It's there for anyone who wants to dig around and do the research. But the mainstream corporate media is complicit in keeping this agenda out of the public eye through its self-censorship of the SPP.
It's unfolding because we're not minding the store, we're not watching, we're watching other things. We haven't been informed. The major media has done a terrible job informing of us of this. The Globe and Mail has not written about the Security and Prosperity Partnership once up until where we are now, the summer of 2007. Not one article, not once has it been mentioned, which is just astounding.
In August 2007, Canada hosted the Security Prosperity Partnership Leaders Summit in Montebello, Quebec. The summit included the three leaders, Stephen Harper, George Bush, Felipe Calderon, and 30 CEOs, 10 from the largest corporations of each country. Leading up to the Montebello summit, the media talked about two stories, the NAFTA superhighway's so-called conspiracies mentioned earlier, and the plight of one of the companies involved in the SPP process. Canaan Brothers Limited, a small company among the corporate giants in attendance, which included Lockheed Martin, Walmart, Home Depot, General Electric, and Merck. The media highlighted the problem that this small chocolate and candy producer was having because of different nutritional labeling requirements in Canada and the United States. This became a key talking point for the summit.
The rules for jelly bean contents are different in Canada and the United States. They have to maintain two separate inventories. Is the sovereignty of Canada going to fall apart if we standardize the jelly bean?
Was this a jelly bean summit? Did George Bush come to Canada for a summit to discuss standardizing jelly beans? The corporate media did cover the anti-SPP rally, but they focused primarily on the violence that occurred after 5 hours of peaceful protest. The final news clip from the SPP summit was the one that wasn't scripted by the Prime Minister and the media months in advance. It's the clip that I shot.
Shut down the SPP!
I decided that I should attend the protest against the SPP summit and follow some of the people who opposed it.
We were told we could present these petitions, which are thousands of petitions from Canadians all across the country, officially and peacefully to a delegation. 1 hour ago, we were told, the RCMP had been told, this is not their decision by Foreign Affairs, that we can no longer submit these petitions. This is a political decision. This means that we're getting the word out on the SPP, and they don't like it, and so they are blocking us here from telling our story in there.
Contrary to media reports, the protest was peaceful and almost carnival-like, but the police ramped up their presence as if they were expecting a riot. After about 3 hours, someone at the back of the protest started throwing rocks and bottles towards the front line. I saw one protester get hit in the head with a rock. Unlike other reporters, I didn't have a helmet or gas mask for protection, so I decided to move to the back of the protest and do some follow-up interviews. That's when I happened upon this scene.
No, no, no. Put the rock down, man! Put the rock down!
Hey!
Put the rock down! This is all right! Get out of town!
Communications, Energy, and Paper Workers Union President Dave Coles was confronting these three masked men with rocks and bottles and accusing them of being police officers. You can see from this footage that they were intent on starting a riot. Watch as the gloved hand of one of these provocateurs hits a member of the riot squad in the face mask. Now watch as he changes hands with the rock and then bangs it into a riot shield. These masked men were attempting to violently disrupt an otherwise peaceful protest. They were breaking the law and violating the constitutionally guaranteed rights of the protesters. The whole scene was surreal. I knew Dave Coles had managed to reveal the face of one of the provocateurs, but I didn't have footage of the other two. I changed roles from independent journalist to citizen on patrol and made sure I captured a second face. The action of these three masked men and the reaction of the riot squad was highly suspect, but ultimately it was the matching boots that gave the provocateurs away. That night I posted the footage on YouTube. For the next 4 days, it was a national and international news story. The Sûreté de Québec denied any involvement, but on the fourth day, they finally admitted it was their officers.
As we confirmed yesterday, the three people in question were indeed Sûreté de Québec police officers performing their duties.
Was this a politically motivated action meant to discredit the protesters as a bunch of radicals and to dissuade other reasonable people from participating in anti-SPP demonstrations? Nobody wants to be pepper sprayed and tear gassed or shot with rubber bullets.
Conflicts over a continent.
The night of the protest, the corporate media followed a typical script, reporting on the violence that did erupt at the protest several hours after the provocateur incident. This violence was started by other provocateurs in the crowd. Were these masked men police officers as well? We can't be sure unless there is a full public inquiry into the Montebello incident, where all the surveillance footage of the protest is analyzed and all undercover operatives revealed. The use of police provocateurs made the threats to democracy under the SPP all the more real. I don't want to be living in a neoconservative-run homeland security police state, and that seems to be where the SPP is taking Canada. The provocateur incident did serve one purpose, though. It helped raise awareness about the SPP among the general public.
Montebello did create a target for people to start talking about this process that nobody was talking about. And when people started talking about it, they didn't like it one bit. Canadians did not like it one bit. Americans didn't like it, and Mexicans didn't like it. So what was so interesting about the Montebello summit is that the whole thing was about playing down the importance of the SPP. And it was really trivialized in the public discussion. It was just about, you know, harmonizing our policies around baby food and jelly beans and children's choice. I mean, there was this weird process of mass infantilization, like every example had to do with kids or babies. Nothing had to do with adults. And the whole discussion was, you're all conspiracy theorists for even thinking this is important, this is minor, this is technical, don't worry about it, look the other way. But then in the final statement, what was said was that this process will advance if there is some kind of a disaster. And they talked about an avian flu outbreak, they talked about a natural disaster. And so they were actually very explicit that this process that was born of a shock, the shock of September 11th, would advance with the next shock. And they actually were quite transparent about it. They were saying, we're not going to do anything now, but the first chance we have to meet a disaster with increased border integration, we will do it. They announced it. They said it publicly. And that fear will be used to push for the SPP agenda, greater presence of U.S. troops and officials on Canadian soil, more integration, and so on. So actually, they're being quite transparent about it. We know where this is going, and we actually shouldn't be shocked. And I think this is one of the things about the shock strategy, is that it does, there is a kind of a law of diminishing returns when you start using the strategy over and over again. So I think that the more people know that this is the way you push through policies that you can't push through during normal times, you need a state of exception, then that means that when that next crisis hits, when that next shock hits, we have to resist the temptation to give in to our fear, to regress, to trust our leaders that they have our best interest, and actually realize that it is in those moments of crisis when we need to be hypervigilant, when we need to keep the closest eye on our political leaders, precisely because we know, and they have told us, helpfully, that this is what they're going to do.
That was the voice of Naomi Klein talking about the SPP, the Security and Prosperity Partnership Agreement between Canada, Mexico, and the United States, known here in the United States as the North American Union. This is a DVD from Canada. It's an hour and a half long. It has extras on it. It's our gift to you today for a $100 contribution to KPFA. We have no one on the phone. We need some people to call up and donate to KPFA. $25 makes you a member. $100 gets you this really very insightful DVD from Canada. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. The SPP is anti-democratic, corporate-driven, and excludes consultation with civil society. 30 corporations will co-govern the process. The SPP integrates Canada into the U.S. war on terror, weakening civil liberties and human rights, no-fly lists, CCTV, data mining, increased police powers, arbitrary arrest, arbitrary detention. The accused can't see evidence against them. 1-800-439-5732. I spoke with the producer of this film, and the Security and Prosperity Partnership, a lot of the elements of it have already been put in place, and they have already changed the name of it, okay? So now it's no longer the Security and Prosperity Partnership Agreement. It has a new name. Hold on. It's called now the Pathway to Prosperity in the Americas, or the PPA, and the North American Standards and Regulatory Area, or NASRA. So what they're doing is they're incrementalizing it, and it's off the radar. So people aren't aware that this is happening. But this process is continuing, and there are two more sections. There's two further agreements that are now finalized between Obama and Stephen Harper in Canada, and they are ready to go into effect. They haven't been announced yet, but they're called the North American Security Perimeter Agreement, having to do with military infrastructure, immigration, and refugees, and another agreement called Beyond Borders, which harmonizes the deregulation of trade regulations. 1-800-439-5732. A $100 donation to KPFA will get you this hour and a half long DVD featuring well-known Canadians, including Maude Barlow, Naomi Klein, and many others. And it goes through all the details of these treaties, because it is complicated, but there's great video footage, and it's easily absorbable by watching the film. What else is in it? It sets the stage for a common foreign policy, one economic, political, military, and security policy for North America. It's an energy grab by the USA. It threatens Canadians' energy security. Canada is required under these agreements to export two-thirds of its oil and over half of its natural gas, even if there is a shortage in Canada, and they have to export those natural resources to the United States. There's an an oil pipeline from Alberta to eastern Canada goes through Chicago. They have to import oil because they are required by these treaties to sell their oil to the United States. It paves the way for U.S. control over Canada's water supplies. It encourages regional integration and free trade zones in areas called, get this, Cascadia and Atlantica. And it breaks the links between East and West. It fast tracks cheap imports. It increases resource extraction and creates trade super corridors. Now, these trade super corridors are very real. It's going to require superports and NAFTA multi-lane superhighway, electrical grids, liquid natural gas terminals, water pipelines, etc. And these things are all going to be running north and south. And it says in the film that Canadians are told to no longer speak about Canada and Canada's resources. It's North America. That's what it is now. It's not Canada. It's North America. And it's really a grab by the USA of Canadian resources. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. Or locally 510-848-5732. 5732. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. $100 will get you this very important film, Canadian film produced by Paul Manley. $100 for the film. $25 makes you a member. And I want to tell you that I also have a gift for $50, and I'm going to get more into this in the next hour, but those of you who can donate $50 to your radio station, I've got an incredible new comic book, The Big Lie. It's a 9/11 comic book, and I'm going to tell you about it in the next hour. It's beautifully done, very clever. I don't want to give the story away. It's beautifully illustrated, lovely colors. It's hit the mainstream media. It's gotten a lot of coverage. It's called The Big Lie. There's a gigantic Uncle Sam towering over the Twin Towers with a flag in his hand. It's called The Big Lie. It's beautifully produced on high-quality, shiny paper stock. And I'll tell you a little bit more about that. But for $50, we can give you The Big Lie comic book. 1-800-439-5732. We have four people on the line. We have room for plenty of more people to step up in the last few minutes and support KPFA. $25 makes you a member. $50, we can send you this really creative and incredible comic book. The comic book starts out with a woman from Switzerland in the year 2011 who time travels back to New York City in September of 2001, I beg your pardon. And she thinks she's there on September 6th, but she's really there on September 11th. And I don't want to give away the story. It's very clever. And the comic book is packed with facts about 9/11. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. $100 donation, and you can get this very informative movie, hour and a half long from Canada, You, Me, and the SPP, Trading Democracy for Corporate Rule. $50, we can send you this really blockbuster new comic book, The Big Lie. $25 makes you a member, but I do need to get a few more people on the phone before we start the hour two. 1-800-439-5732, 510-848-5732. So the multilateral agreement on investment supposedly went down in flames in late 1990s, but the Security and Prosperity Partnership has brought it back. And what it really does is give power to investors to challenge local, municipal, state, and national laws, any kind of regulations to protect the environment, to protect workers. All of these regulations can be challenged in court. A municipality can be sued for $5 million if any of their rules or their policies can be shown to be an impediment to investment. And let's face it, a lot of policies and maybe most regulations that protect people, that protect the environment, they really are an impediment to investment. So if investors or businesses, corporations can show that they're not making as much profit as they could be without these regulations, then they can be challenged in court. And that is why these agreements are so very dangerous. They're happening right now. They're off the radar. The media is not covering it. And people really aren't aware of it. It's not like back in the late 90s with the global uprising against the World Trade Organization. As I mentioned before, that was all brought to a halt by the events of 9/11. That's why 9/11 is such a very, very important subject, because obviously it figures very heavily in these trade treaties. It brought a lot of stuff to a halt. 1-800-439-5732, 800-439-5732, or here in the East Bay, 510-848-5732.